On this week's 51%, we speak with Dickinson College professor Amy Farrell about her forthcoming book, Intrepid Girls, and learn about the bold and complicated history of the Girl Scouts of the USA.
The Girl Scouts have never used the word feminism. That was always the case, is that kind of fine line between not going too far, but really carving out more of a space. It's certainly not just being a kind of helpmate to boys.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The Girl Scouts of the USA have become a staple of American girlhood. Whether you were a Girl Scout or not, and I certainly remember my days in Troop 52 very well, you're familiar with the green and brown vests, badges, and of course, the thin mints. Since 1912, the Girl Scouts have been empowering girls to learn new skills, make new friends, and sell cookies. Our guest today is a former Girl Scout herself. For her forthcoming book, she decided to dive into the history of an organization she loved, and she found it a lot more complicated than she was expecting. Amy Farrell is a professor at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, where her classes and research have focused on the history of feminism and the representation of gender and fatness in popular culture. Her new book, Intrepid Girls, combines years of historical research and personal interviews to detail how the Girl Scouts empowered girls across the country and how it also segregated scouts of color, avoided the word feminist, and struggled to navigate America's own complicated history.
I had always, though, in the back of my mind, been a bit curious about this organization that had been so important to me, but that I really didn't know much about.
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning, I guess, you know, when the Girl Scouts got started. And you talk about its founder in your book. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's Juliet Gordon Lowe.
Juliet Gordon Lowe. So she was a woman who was born right before the Civil War in the United States in Savannah, Georgia, Juliet Gordon. So she's from a white Southern family, a very wealthy family, a slaveholding family. So that's an important fact to know. Her mom was actually from Chicago, so was a Northern woman. And when Juliet Gordon got married, she married a man named Willie Lowe. And he was a cotton factor, which is it's a position where you're selling and buying cotton. So he was also involved with the sort of aftermath of the enslaved population and the cotton industry. And that's how his family had made money. So she moves to England, though she certainly keeps her ties in Savannah. She moves to England, and it turns out not to be a happy marriage. They don't have any children. He turns out to be a philanderer, so he's with other women and also doing a lot of gambling. He's just about to divorce her when he dies. And so she is a widow, and she inherits his money and is also wealthy on her own side of the family. And that's a whole nother story, because she actually has to sue for so that she can. He initially left his money to the mistress, but she was able to get the money. And she meets Lord Robert Baden-Powell, who is the founder of the Boy Scouts in England. And she's really enamored with him and with the Boy Scouts. And he asks her to actually lead one of the Girl Guide groups, which was the sister organization to the Boy Scouts. She comes back to Savannah. And as the story goes, she says, "I have something for all the girls of America." And she starts what she then calls the Girl Scouts. She does not bring the name Girl Guides. She brings the name, she changes it to Girl Scouts, because she says that just fits a U.S. situation better. So she founds it in 1912. It is never in the United States the sister organization to the Boy Scouts, as the Girl Guides are in the U.K. And in fact, the Boy Scouts are pretty resistant to her founding of the Girl Scouts, because they really don't like her taking the name Scout. They say it's really emasculating to boys, and the girls are just aping women, and they're acting like they're like little men. And the Boy Scouts in the United States much prefer the Campfire Girls, which they say is much more domestic and much more a helpmate kind of thing to the Girl Scouts. So it gets started in 1912. over the years, it grows to be because there are other organizations that are very similar to the Girl Scouts actually at the time, progressive era organizations designed for youth. But she's a formidable woman, and she's actually also able to really recruit other society women and powerful women who really are taken with her message about an organization for girls. And so it grows. My research, though, is less about her per se, more about the beginning of my book, more about sort of the myths that have been told about her, the stories, and how that has worked. But then thinking about all the different kind of avenues in which the Girl Scouts went. So that's where my book really takes us.
You mentioned there were other girls' groups at the time, and some of them were a little bit more domestic, like the Campfire Girls. I guess what brand of femininity did the Girl Scouts promote, and has it changed much over the years?
Right. That's a really interesting question. Girl Scouts have always, and I would say that this has been true from its very origins, walked a fine line where, and in fact, that's why the title Intrepid Girls, because they really encouraged an intrepidness, you know, a kind of adventuresome point of view, courageous, skilled. In fact, when I even describe my Girl Scout experiences in the 1970s, I would say I learned to be competent in many things. You know, you learn that you can do things. And that is true from the very beginning. But it did not call itself feminist and never would. Julia Gordon Low was not a suffragist, although there were Girl Scouts who were. You know, I'm not saying that there were no Girl Scouts who were, but she was not. And the Girl Scouts have never used the word feminism. It's a kind of fine line where the domestic arts, everything from sewing to child rearing and just all the things that we might need to keep our homes and home life going, those are important, but also is camping and outdoor skills and now STEM, for instance. But that was always the case, is that kind of fine line between not going too far, if you will, but really carving out more of a space. And not, it's certainly not just being a kind of helpmate to men or to boys.
Things like hikes, it sounds like they were doing that from the start. I guess what kinds of activities did the girls do? Because I think when I look back on even my own time in the Girl Scouts, we definitely did a lot more knitting and crocheting as opposed to camping.
Yeah, you know, it really depends on the troop. And who the leaders are, what one's experience is. And in a certain way, that kind of localness has probably been the organization's strength because it can speak to whatever the leaders are kind of wanting to do. But it also means that some girls are going to have amazing experiences and some girls' experiences are probably going to be more limited, like yours were. So for me, like we did traveling, we did like lots of hiking. I was the one who sort of stopped some of the hiking because I hated the camping that at the time we called primitive camping. I didn't like the things that to me were a bit too miserable, you know, but other girls in the troop did, you know, and they went and they were actually encouraged to do all those things. But I'd say from the beginning, Girl Scouts weren't alone in this. There was really, and this is really was true for the Boy Scouts as well, that there was an attempt to an idea that urbanization had really gone too far, and that in terms of for boys, it was really a kind of sense that they were becoming demasculized, I guess it would be the word, that in urban life, weakening them. But Julia Gordon Low, I think, had that same belief in terms of girls, that girls needed to really get out and enjoy camping and hiking. The term that was used in the early years was tramping.
At what point did the cookies enter the picture?
Well, troops did things to raise their own money from the very beginning. In the 30s, troops were, there were a lot of records of different troops making their own cookies and selling them. So you can still find online like the diff, well, some of them are different. So I don't know that they're all original, but like some of the original, they're basically shortbread recipes for cookies that were for sale. But it was starting really in the 40s and then became very popular in the 50s that the Girl Scouts of the USA licensed different bakeries around the country to bake cookies and sell them. And that's why, even to this day, the cookies might taste somewhat different depending upon where you're getting them in the world, which bakery it's actually coming from, which commercial bakery it's coming from. And then that money For the most part, stays with the troop and then the local council. So it has been a way for Girl Scouts to make and fund a lot of their programming. It's and really to teach this kind of entrepreneurship to girls as well.
You talk in the book about how the messaging for the Girl Scouts has always been about inclusion and that, you know, like we're an organization for all girls. But especially in those early days, that wasn't how it panned out for a lot of Girl Scouts, including Black Girl Scouts. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, because I study and teach about US culture, I was really interested in questions about race. And the story that the Girl Scouts tells about itself is really that it was always a diverse organization for all girls. And the organization will often highlight pictures where you see, especially black and white girls together. And while those things are not wrong, like those images, there's no doctored images that I came up with or anything like that. Those are certainly true moments. It's a deeper and more difficult history. And I would say that it gets at the heart of some of the questions that we need to think about in terms of US culture as well and how we've dealt with segregation and race in the United States in general. So the Girl Scouts, were from the beginning ambivalent about welcoming African American girls. According to the scholarship that I read and that I became familiar with, Julia Gordon Lowe's mom, in fact, wanted to prevent Black girls from actually joining Girl Scouts. And Julia Gordon Lowe disagreed with that, but she was very ambivalent about Black membership and especially was concerned that too many Black members would actually ruin the reputation of Girl Scouts. And so she really wanted that to be kind of downplayed. She actually leaves the picture in terms of the, well, she dies in the 20s, and she had become more involved in the kind of international wing of Girl Scouting and Girl Guiding. But the Girl Scout organization as a whole is very concerned about Black membership. And so they have different ways to control it and to keep a lid on actually a lot of enthusiasm by Black women, especially to start Girl Scouting for their own daughters and the girls in their own community. And I think the reason for the enthusiasm is the fact that, as we know, African American girls have often been treated like adults far before their time. And so for Black women, this was a way to say, we want a space for our girls to have a space of safety and a space for them to actually be able to be girls. So I think that's where a lot of the enthusiasm came from. But there was never a policy that said, we won't let in Black girls. It was never anything like that. But here is what happened. There are a couple of policies that really kept a lid on Black membership and ensured segregation if councils wanted to segregate. And one was called the Lone Troop Rule. So troops, when they first started, when Girl Scouts would start in an area, a troop would just form, do you know? So like you could start one, do you know? And you could just write to the national headquarters and say, I'd like to start a troop, and you could start one. But you were not allowed to start one if you weren't white. And so those initial freestanding troops could only be white. And that meant because a council really got formed because a bunch of lone troops came together into an area. And so it meant that the origin of any council was by default then white. And then it also, there was a deference to local rule. And so if a council said, we only want so many Black troops, or an individual troop didn't want to welcome a Black member, that could be tolerated if that was tolerated in that local area. And so I think for me, what was really important is for us to look at the reality that even when an organization, and I think this is true of US history in general, even when an organization says it's democratic and says it's inclusive, what are the policies that actually have worked in just the opposite direction? And so then, in fact, I think when there's not honesty around that, it means when people call out the racism or call out the discrimination, they can be treated as the ones who are quote unquote crazy or making too big a deal about it. when in reality, they're not at all. They're just experiencing and noting the policies that are preventing membership. And there was explicit discrimination through the 40s and 50s, really into the 60s. And that was in the North and South. So it wasn't just a Southern problem. Camps, for instance, which were so important to the history of Girl Scouting, for the most part, did not welcome Black members, except for really probably at the end of the season, sometimes even after the summer had ended, or maybe one or two girls of particular high social standing, but not really encouraging Black membership in their camps. And that's part of this book is my own memories of my own, experiences in the 70s. So my camp, Camp Ledgewood, was officially desegregated in the 40s, but I know that my experience growing up in the 70s was that it was a completely white camp. That's my memory. I'm not saying that there were not any Black girls who went. I have a memory of one African American counselor. So those things had after effects that went far past when the policies maybe ended.
You write in the book that there were even Girl Scout troops in the Japanese incarceration centers in the 40s?
Yeah, there were. So when Roosevelt gave his order to imprison people of Japanese descent, the Girl Scouts pretty quickly signed on with the US government to provide Girl Scouting in the internment camps, in the incarceration centers. That I knew nothing about that when I started this project. It is really a multi-layered story of the Girl Scouts agreeing to do this. And I think at some points in their own history, really seeing it as a kind of altruistic act. I think the reality was that they're really working in conjunction with the government. And it had to be so complicated for the girls who, as I point out, because they were asked to do things like be the ones who were the hostesses for the days when prisoners could meet people coming in from the outside. Or greet trains coming in, dropping off new prisoners. But they were prisoners themselves, do you know? So it's almost as if it's such a complicated thing. But my take on it was really, it was as if the Girl Scouts were asking the girls to be their own in prisoners. It's really difficult, I think, to go back and see for myself as a former Girl Scout, to see Girl Scouts' complicity in that incarceration. Having said that, again, though, it always feels like everything that I study here gets complicated because for many of the girls, it was one of the only positive experiences they had while they were imprisoned. In one oral history, for instance, that I listened to, this now adult woman, she is remembering the camp and just how horrific it was, how the problems her family faced. First she was put into a, they were imprisoned and gathered up in a racetrack and then sent out to the camp. Horrible conditions, really faced sexual assault. The weather was boiling and then freezing. I mean, it was just horrible, horrible experience. And someone says, the interviewer says to her, do you have any good memories from that time? And she said, no, not really. Well, actually, I do the Girl Scouts. That scouting was the one place, probably because she had enough little more room. She had another outfit she could wear. Sometimes they were even able to petition to be able to go like to a camp, like not an imprisoned camp, like go out to a park or go do something else. And often it was older girls who were also imprisoned, or some of the young women who were imprisoned who were the leaders, So it did provide some space for fun and joy and resilience within these camps.
We're speaking with Amy Farrell, author of Intrepid Girls. One thing that really surprised me, you dedicate a section in the book to a period in the 1950s when the Girl Scouts were accused of promoting the Communist Party agenda. And I guess my questions to you are, one, how? And two, I don't know, was there any truth to that? Did the Girl Scouts get political?
So I'm just going to cut to that last question. As far as I could tell, there was absolutely no official connection between the Girl Scouts of the USA and the Communist Party at all. Having said that, though, Individual leaders. It wasn't that unheard of to be a member of the Communist Party, say in the 20s or 30s. And so individual leaders could have been, and then their membership could have even, continued on. In that sort of the Red Scare, a lot of what got scooped up into that was anyone who was advocating for women's rights, anyone who was advocating for civil rights, so rights and knowledge about Black history or civil rights, or anyone who is actually interested in world peace. So the Girl Scouts were involved in encouraging students, girls, members to learn about the United Nations, to really think about being a sister to other girls around the world. And on the one hand, we could see that as kind of the arm of US imperialism, but a lot of girls and leaders and staff took that very seriously, And so, no, there was absolutely no evidence that I saw that the GSUSA was ever involved with the Communist Party. But yes, there were a thrust within Girl Scouting that was interested in world peace, that was interested in women's rights, and that was interested in civil rights. And those people often got sort of scooped up as potential communists. And that's where the attacks, especially by the American Legion against the Girl Scouts, that this was a radical organization, that this was a communist organization. And the Girl Scouts resisted it sometimes by just saying that's nonsense and we're not going to do anything. As the attacks became stronger, there was some working with the handbook to take out some of the quote unquote egregious language. I mean, the egregious language was language about the United Nations and language about world communities and world peace that were certainly not communist. And so it was really answering to this kind of attack from above, that they really censored some of their language. And that's not to say too, and I have some examples in the book of individual troop leaders who were asked to resign because their politics were deemed too radical. That definitely did happen. But then, as I also point out, Girl Scouts as a whole, and that's where the cookies come back in, sort of could resist also by saying, hey, we're just Girl Scouts. We're just like an organization with little sweet girls and we sell cookies. How could we be dangerous? I think that's such an interesting defense, right? Because on the one hand, maybe it gets people off your back, but on the other hand, it's saying we're not that important, So there's a level where it means you can then go under the radar, but you also don't claim your own power, And so actually, this was an organization that was teaching girls. It was attention, right? But there was an aspect of Girl Scouting that was teaching girls to worry about fairness, and to say in the name of Girl Scouting, we're not going to tolerate segregation, And in the name of Girl Scouting, we think it is important to actually work for world peace. And instead of claiming that, there was sort of like a cutting down in the language to fit a narrower stance, and then also to sort of hide by saying we're just sweet girls.
You say the organization doesn't describe itself as a feminist organization, that it doesn't even use the word feminist. I guess looking at the Girl Scouts today, how have their programs changed and what is the message today?
Yeah. I tell a story in the book about going to visit my former camp in Northern Ohio and taking a tour of the camp, and many of the things just look so much the same, and some of them were different, all these zip lines and stuff that weren't there when I was there. But it was also the beginning of a big new STEM center. So I think that that is one of the ways that Girl Scouts is what I think is that Girl Scouts sort of make a case for feminism by never actually saying feminism, So STEM, I think now is sort of one of those areas that it can kind of say, we really want girls to take up space, to feel competent, to know that they can go into areas that are deemed kind of male areas. But that's one of the arenas where I think they're doing that, definitely. And that was an interesting moment too, because I asked the, it was actually the CEO of Northeastern Ohio Girl Scouts, I asked her about the Dobbs decision, the decision that was really limiting reproductive rights in the United States. And she did not want to talk about that. Do you know? And she said, we're not political. And so I think my point just is that there are strengths, or I don't know if strengths, it's a strategy to not discuss anything political. It's a strategy to say we're not going to face head-on questions about reproductive rights or questions about race, et cetera. But it means that you then, you know, I was thinking, how is a girl going to be able to be active in STEM if she can't control her own pregnancy? Do you know, or if she's endangered with her pregnancy and can't get the kind of care she needs? So I think that there's always this attempt to kind of move and take up space. And to be fair to certain councils and certain troops, et cetera, will be more explicit and more brave, do you know? And others will either because they disagree with that or because they're worried about backlash will back off.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in 2017, the Boy Scouts began accepting girls as members. Has that impacted the Girl Scouts at all? And do you see the Girl Scouts, I guess, ever deciding to accept boy members?
Yeah, so it's interesting. For all those decades that Boy Scouts had actually sued the Girl Scouts for using the name Scout, it flipped in 2017, you know, and Girl Scouts are suing the boys for taking the name Scout because that was not a joint decision between the two organizations by any means. Boy Scouts, I would argue, really incorporated girls not because of an actual interest in girls' leadership skills and abilities. I would say it was really a response to the problems that they had been facing, especially with the lawsuits connected to sexual assault. And so it was really a move to try and shore up membership. But Girl Scouts have, at least to this date, are steadfastly committed to being an organization for girls, for anyone who identifies as girl or non-binary usually. So that element is somewhat open to council interpretation and to troop interpretation, but they are really focused on the empowerment of girls and say that there's something specific about an organization that is not co-ed. So I don't know what the future will bring, but if it did welcome boys, it wouldn't just be, my sense of the organization is it wouldn't just be like we just are bringing in boys now. I think that there's really paying attention to that we live in a gendered world, that this isn't a world that is just neutral. And so that different groups of people are going to need different kinds of support skills, et cetera, or safety.
Amy Farrell is a professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and she's also the author of Intrepid Girls, The Complicated History of the Girl Scouts of the USA. It's out October 28th from the University of North Carolina Press. You can learn more about Amy's work at dickinson.edu. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. sweet baby.